you like to tell me what's been bothering you?
No, I don't like being outdoors.
Tell me you've left the house in 3 days.
Mm. 1, 2, 3.
Have you eaten anything in 3 days?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Besides canned tuna?
Mm-mm.
Anything else?
Dirt. Obviously, I have a lot of ticks.
These distractions affected you workably? What would you do if you had to change careers?
What, if I wasn't an antiques broker?
If you weren't a criminal.
I'm Agent Kellaway. This is Agent Cole. We're from the Federal Trade Commission.
You've been the victim of fraud.
Do you have any more of those L-47s?
Yeah, maybe in the car. Oh, wait a second. Oh, here we go.
This is Dr. Klein. I just got off the phone with Angela, your daughter. She says she really wants to meet you.
Remember me?
All of a sudden, I have a daughter.
Somebody in here!
Hallelujah, you got a chick in here?
It's a riot, huh? Little training bras hanging on the shower rods?
That's no way for a young lady to behave, and shame on you!
Just try to be as honest and open with them as possible.
Right.
You're a con man?
Con artist.
Wow.
Flim flam man, matchstick man, take your pick.
And that guy, Frank?
He's my partner.
Teach me something.
Rule number one, never work near where you live.
Don't.
Rule number two, don't write anything down.
You regret it, exposing her to that?
Well, you know, it was a little, it made me feel a little, you know, it was a little, I really liked it. How much do you think we can take that guy for?
$30,000.
More.
$500,000? A million? Come on, I'm 21.
This 14-year-old girl working these people with me.
My dad is smooth operator.
I'm not very good at being a dad. I barely get by being me.
You good to go?
Is a Pope Poo in the woods?
Just say yes, okay? There's one last thing.
What?
I want you to give the money back.
This is so... You think crime isn't paid?
No, it does. It does, just not very well.
Hello, and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCriscio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. It's good to be back. Back in Complete Works land.
Yeah, it's been a few weeks since we've recorded our last episode, but we are back, and we're hopefully back on a real schedule, but we'll see what happens. Life is
that's
crazy.
That's a lot. It's a big ask, Mike. Big
ask. It's crazy sometimes. But now, I'm going to be completely out in the open here, Mike. There are a few incredibly specific subgenres of movies that I really, really love.
All right.
For example... Look, I'm a big fan of movies focused on kids in suburbia who find themselves in extraordinary and dangerous situations with no adult supervision. Like, that's a subgenre of movie that I really enjoy, right?
That seems reasonable.
Another incredibly specific subgenre of movie that I'm a big fan of is movies about con artists, particularly when those con artists are father and daughter figures. I think that's a really great dynamic. There's so much fun to be had in that dynamic. It's the basis of the 1973 movie Paper Moon, and it's the basis here for Ridley Scott's 2003 Nicolas Cage film Matchstick Men. Now, Mike, you had seen this once before, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think I'd seen it a few times.
Really?
Yeah. One of those kind of in passing on TV type things. That said, I didn't really remember it a whole lot, which I don't know what that says about it, but...
All right, well, I had never seen Matchstick Men before, but Ridley Scott is a director who I've been a fan of for a long time. You know, he's been working pretty consistently since the 1970s with classics to his name, Alien, Blade Runner, Gladiator. Most recently, you know, he's back on the Alien franchise with Prometheus and Alien Covenant. He did The Martian. He's also one of the most frustrating filmmakers alive today, whose work is often severely flawed or borderline incoherent on a storytelling level, because he works purely on a visual level, right? That's, I think, the best thing you can say about Ridley Scott is I think he is one of the most visually compelling filmmakers working today. And Film Crit Hulk actually posted a really great essay about Ridley Scott on Birth, Movies, Death recently. And in the comments, somebody was discussing how Ridley Scott's process works when he's being pitched ideas. Apparently, if he likes something, he sketches it out in the pitch meeting and then hands it over to some artists and has them create concept art for it to have ready for him by the next day so he can see what it would look like.
Holy shit.
Yeah. He's a very detail-oriented, stylistic filmmaker whose emphasis is creating powerful imagery first with a story to back it up later. And Scott's movies tend to be a bit slower and more epic in scope, so I was kind of surprised when watching Matchstick Men how quickly it all kind of moved along. You know, this is a kind of an it's a Ridley Scott movie, but it doesn't feel like one in the same sense that like Alien does, you know, or Blade Runner does.
Right.
The pacing and the editing, the performance, they all kind of seem like something out of a film that his brother Tony Scott would have made. Tony Scott was a lot more known for action movies like Crimson Tide and Top Gun and all that stuff. And so this is also kind of a smaller scale project for him this period in his career, after having made Gladiator, Hannibal, and Black Hawk Down all back to back, and before moving on to another large scale epic, 2005's Kingdom of Heaven.
Let me just do this little father daughter con man movie.
Yeah, just throw that in there. Why not? But that's the thing about Ridley Scott, is he comes out with a movie like every 1 or 2 years. Like he's been working pretty much nonstop since like 1979 when Alien came out. And I should note, he was 40 years old when he directed Alien for the first time, or when he directed the first Alien. Like, he was relatively late into his career when he made Alien.
Right.
Like, he was a production designer for most of, like, the first half of his life. and since then, he's just been cranking out movies every year, every 2 years, every couple of years. And I really enjoy most of what he does, at least on some level. Like, I feel like there's... at least on a visual level, like I was talking about Prometheus a while back when we did our Alien Covenant podcast, which you can listen to at filmbook.com. We just reviewed that movie pretty recently. We were talking about Prometheus and Alien Covenant and how those movies are very flawed, right? Like we were discussing both of them and talking about how like those movies have a lot of issues with them, but also there's this beauty to both of them that it's really enticing, and like there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening underneath the surface. That makes for a really compelling movie, I think. With this one, there's a sense that Ridley Scott is just having some breezy fun, you know? it's kind of allowing him to stretch some cinematic tricks he hadn't gotten to play with before, and the movie feels a lot better for it, for me at least. The movie is based on a novel that was released a year earlier by Eric Garcia and written by Ted and Nicholas Griffin. Ted Griffin also worked on the screenplay for another iconic con artist film, Steven Soderbergh's Ocean's 11.
Wow, yeah. Look at that.
So that's pretty wild. And both brothers also worked on the FX show Terriers, which has become a cult classic. It only lasted one season, but it's the kind of show where... are you familiar with Terriers, Mike?
No, I don't even know if I've heard of it.
Really? That lasted for like one season in like 2010, and FX canceled that after the one season. This was around the time, like right when FX was on the verge of becoming a major network, right? Like and they canceled Terriers right before they started getting into the groove of a bunch of great shows, and even though they had low ratings, they wouldn't get canceled because of the critical acclaim. They ended up canceling Terriers, and Terriers is the kind of show where the fans are so hardcore that to this day they're like, where's the new season of Terriers kind of thing? You know?
Wow. That's impressive.
That said, I've never seen a single episode of Terriers, but still.
So who knows? Could be anything.
That could be a whole community that I know nothing about. Now, Nicolas Cage stars in the lead role of Matchstick Men as Roy Waller, a con man suffering from obsessive-compulsive disorder who meets his daughter for the first time. And the past couple of years have been a bit of a mixed bag for Cage, with only Adaptation being a film that got critical attention and awards recognition. You know, the ones surrounding it, let's say in 2001, 2002, Captain Corelli's Mandolin, Christmas Carol the movie, Wind Talkers, and his directorial debut, Sonny. So, yeesh. Now, Matchstick Men was not a box office hit, but it did get very solid reviews and would lead right into his next box office smash, which was 2004's National Treasure. That movie was a big hit, and we'll be talking about that on the next episode of The Complete Works. We're eager to dive into that one. I feel like that's going to be a fun one. So Nicolas Cage plays Roy Waller in the film, and he's paired up with Sam Rockwell, another one of my favorite actors, whose career could also support a podcast like this one, I feel like.
Maybe it would have been better, but we'll never know.
Acting like you're unsatisfied with our Nicolas Cage podcast, Mike.
I would never want to put that out there into the world.
Except on every episode that we've done. No. but Rockwell brings this kind of weird, nervous energy to everything he touches, you know? And that's exactly what it does here as Frank Mercer, I think. Meanwhile, Nicolas Cage's daughter, Angela, is played by Alison Lohman, who is probably best known as the lead in Sam Raimi's awesome 2009 horror film Drag Me to Hell. And her character in this movie is 14 years old. And at the time of filming, she was 23. And she is so good at playing younger that even though I knew she had to be older than 14, as I was watching this movie, because I knew she was older than that when Drag Me to Hell came out. She had to be like at least 30 when Drag Me to Hell came out, and this movie came out 6 years earlier. There's no way she was 14. But I found myself questioning my own knowledge.
What is reality, Mike? We'll never know.
And apparently, Alison Lohman actually went through her audition, dressed as like a 14-year-old, and Ridley Scott only realized her age after she told him, which is nuts, which I think is a testament to how freaking good Alison Lohman is in this movie, like that she can convincingly play a preteen, or somebody who's barely a teen at the age of 23. That's kind of insane. The rest of the cast is filled with some very solid character actors. Bruce Altman, who appeared in movies like Glengarry Glen Ross and Girl Interrupted, plays Dr. Harris Klein, Cage's therapist. Bruce McGill, known for his role in Animal House and a few Michael Mann movies, plays the quote-unquote bad guy, Chuck Frechette. Sheila Kelly, who was on L.A. Law and recently appeared as the mother in the movie The Guest, plays Kathy, the grocery store worker Cage has a crush on. What's so funny, Mike? What are you laughing?
It's just all of the supporting roles are so supporting in this. It leans so heavily on Cage, Rockwell, and Lohman that the other worthy people to mention is the grocery store.
You're gonna love the credit for the next one. Beth Grant, who is on The Mindy Project and has appeared in a whole lot of movies, plays a character named Laundry Lady. So there's that. Jenny O'Hara and Steve Easton play Mr. and Mrs. Schaefer, the old couple at the beginning of the movie. And Steve Easton appeared in Con Air as a prison guard, so there's a Cage reunion there as well, so that's pretty cool. Melora Walters plays Cage's ex-wife Heather, and she's known for her role on Big Love, and she's also been in a couple of Paul Thomas Anderson movies. And finally, this one I got really excited about when he showed up. Fran Kranz makes an appearance towards the end as Slacker Boyfriend. He's known for his work with Joss Whedon, having a main role on Dollhouse, and also playing the stoner in Cabin in the Woods. As soon as he started off, I was like, yeah, that's Frank Kranz. I was super excited. I actually saw Frank Kranz perform live once.
Wow, look at you go.
I saw him in a production of Death of a Salesman in 2012, along with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Andrew Garfield. It was a pretty crazy show.
Man.
Directed by Mike Nichols. Wild times. Beautiful. Wild times. Anyway, Matchstick Men was made for a budget of $62 million, made about $65 million. So it was not a hit, or not a runaway success. It was written by Ted and Nicholas Griffin and based on the book by Eric Garcia. The movie features a score by Hans Zimmer and was edited by Dodie Dorn, who is probably most well known as the editor of Memento. And Ridley Scott directed the film 2 years after Black Hawk Down and 2 years before Gladiator. No, that's wrong. 2 years before... 2 years before Kingdom of Heaven, I should say.
You played yourself, Mike.
I played myself. I wrote this an hour ago, and I am exhausted, man. That's anyway, the IMDb plot synopsis for Matchstick Men is a phobic con artist and his protege are on the verge of pulling off a lucrative swindle when the former's teenage daughter arrives unexpectedly. Now, ooh. Mike, you've seen Matchstick Men before. So you're going into this sort of with fresh eyes. I mean, you've seen it before, but it's not fresh in your memory. It wasn't really fresh in your memory. So what were your overall thoughts on Matchstick Men?
My overall thoughts were that it was mostly pretty fun. I think the first half, or first act at least, is a lot of fun. We're with Roy and Frank, Cage and Rockwell, doing their slimy con man thing. Rockwell is... the Rockwelliest he's ever been, I think. Not ever, but he's dancing and being charming and the ladies' man and talking Cage into doing crazy stuff.
Yes,
and it's a lot of fun. That's what I love him as a character actor when he does that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I really this is the Sam Rockwell appreciation thread. He is the best.
He's
so good in everything. I mean, he was great in Seven Psychopaths and Galaxy Quest. He's a lot of fun. I always thought that. He was in Iron Man 2 as the bad guy in that movie, but I always thought if they didn't cast him in that movie, if they ever needed to recast Tony Stark, Sam Rockwell would have been my choice.
Oh my God, that's amazing. there's some great compilations on YouTube of just Sam Rockwell dancing in every role that he's ever been in, and it's hilarious. Check them out.
Will do.
So yeah, that's a lot of fun. I think Cage, we get to experience Cage as someone with OCD to the most extreme level. There's a couple breakdowns that he has that are hilarious and wild to look at, just as we were talking about Ridley Scott as a visual director. and especially with the editor of Memento, there's smash cuts to him scrubbing the floor with toothbrushes to smash cuts to him doing all this crazy neurotic cleaning in wild, I think, like a Tony Scott montage style. So it's interesting. It's Ridley Scott doing that.
Yeah. It's actually, I think that is a really interesting part of the movie when Cage starts having his breakdowns and the editing gets like noticeably faster and like more intense as it goes on. And I think that like visually helps sell the breakdown that Cage is having. I think it's a cool feature of the movie.
Definitely. I think that it is interesting. Once Alison Lohman shows up as the daughter, I think it slams the brakes on a little bit for me personally. And this is where me not particularly remembering the movie hurt the movie of having seen it before, because there's a twist, as a con man movie is wont to do.
And in
my brain, I was like, this is a super predictable twist. How could they? Come on. And then I had second thoughts where I was like, is that me just remembering the movie? Because I didn't know what was happening. My note is super obvious. We're going to spoil it, I guess, right? Super obvious twist with the daughter, question mark? And I couldn't, but yeah. But that's, you know, could just be a fault of the movie. Maybe the twist kind of ruins it. Once you know the thing, it doesn't warrant a second watch. I don't know if that is a fair statement.
That's quite possible. Here's the thing. I had not seen Matchstick Men. I really liked it. I thought this was a really fun movie. I think it's really engaging, tightly edited. You know, the performances and the character dynamics, they're all very strong. And then there's the twist at the end. And I wasn't quite sure the twist at the end worked for me at first. You know, it seemed like it was a little too elaborate, like a little too perfect. Like, there's no possible way that this could possibly work.
How could that? Yeah.
But ultimately, I think it did work because of where it kind of brings Cage as a character by the end of the movie. It, like, forces him. It forces him to heal, to work through his OCD, build in a relationship, etc. So I did like that about it. But I also had that kind of same feeling when the movie ended, when I was like, I feel like if I watched the movie again with the twist in mind, it would ultimately hurt the movie. We'll talk about the twist in a little bit. But basically, everything is a lie. And so nothing in the movie actually happened. And so you're watching it, and it's like, well, why am I watching this? Like, nothing's... because there's no... Like, now you know there's nothing at stake, really, except... really, like, this character's not in danger. This character's not actually in danger. This character's not actually in danger. Oh, okay. So that's kind of it.
Yeah, the best twists allow you to, you know, fundamentally change the meaning and the plot of the movie, right? And once you know them, you can go back and watch it a second time, and everything has new meaning.
And it will enrich the thing that thing you just watched.
Or render it all moot. It's
right.
One or the other.
Yeah, I have a fairly controversial opinion that The Usual Suspects, which everybody knows for the twist, right? That Kevin Spacey's Kaiser Soze, spoilers.
What? No.
But that's played as a big twist ending, right? That Kevin Spacey is telling this whole story about Kaiser Soze throughout the entire movie, and then it turns out Kevin Spacey is Kaiser Soze. And that's really cool at first, but I think if you watch Usual Suspects again, it does hurt that movie quite a bit, because it's like, well, everything in the movie was made up. Like, it's a lie.
Yeah. The whole movie never happened.
Yeah, and so I do think The Usual Suspect, that's a fairly controversial opinion. I know people really love that movie, but...
It's a hot take, Mike.
It is a fairly hot take. But I really did enjoy Matchstick Men this first time around anyway. Everything about it just screams slick, you know? It's just a slick movie. Yeah. Like Ridley Scott saw Ocean's 11 and thought, yeah, I can do that.
yeah, that seems fun.
Yeah. Let's do that. Take a break from Hannibal and shoot this. Like, yeah. So what did you think of Nicolas Cage in this movie, Mike?
Man, there's a lot happening in this movie for Nicolas Cage.
There is.
I think he's approaching his peak in terms of marketability, his just as a leading man, right? Like, we're kind of in, we're past action hero golden era, and we're into just, I don't know how else to describe it other than leading man, right? Movie star, movie star Cage, right?
Movie star Cage, yeah.
Yeah, and I think he delivers a really solid performance as Roy, with all the visual and or facial tics that this character has throughout the whole movie, pretty much. And they're played kind of for a lark, right, for the most part, when they get really excessive, like it's just for the joke.
Right.
But there's a lot of this movie where he is just, like, has all these facial tics like in earnest, which feels really weird to say. but it's true.
Yeah, I agree. I think he is legit great in this movie in Matchstick Men. You know, I think he's playing a different type of character than what I expected. When you go into a con man movie, you expect to see like the smooth con man just conning everybody, doing his cons, conning all over the place.
The Sam Rockwell con man.
Yeah, I was expecting him to be a lot like Sam Rockwell's character in this movie. Or you have like the one like cool-headed hot con man and the hot-headed con man, and they get into, you know, the hot-headed one gets the cool one in trouble and stuff like that. That's kind of the trope that you expect. I don't think I've ever seen one that has like this kind of debilitated con man character.
Yeah, just neurotic.
Yeah. And so I think to that end, I think that's a really interesting character choice. And it's the kind of Cage role that works the actor's eccentricities into the character. And we've talked about that in the past. So Cage can have fun digging into, you know, the physical and vocal tics to play around with, but it always feels like a natural extension of what that character would do. And so I think that's cool. And he also has great chemistry with Sam Rockwell, and his relationship with Alison Lohman is surprisingly touching, and it feels very realistic, I feel like, throughout the movie, and then it all turns out to be a lie. But I think it really does work. And then there's one great detail I noticed throughout the movie is that Cage's, you know, vocal and physical tics, they disappear. They fall to the wayside the minute he starts playing a character for a con. And I really liked that about his character, as if he's like only truly comfortable when playing the part of someone else who isn't a neurotic mess. You know, like that's kind of his thing. Or when he's in the high of pulling off a crime. That's like the only time when he's not completely debilitated by this OCD. That was cool.
I think the sort of introduction to his OCD is really interesting in that very first con with the old couple. Right. When the woman opens the door to like let her dog out or something, and he sees the bright sun and all the dust floating in the air, and it knocks him off his game, and he almost blows the con. I thought that was a really cool introduction to.
I also like that. I also immediately thought of Vampire's Kiss.
Oh my god! I didn't put that together. It's perfect.
The cage being affected by the sun.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty great. But also, like his character in The Rock, I noticed this. Cage doesn't really curse in this movie when he's not playing a character. He does curse occasionally when he's like in character or when he's in his freak out modes or whatever. But when he's just general Cage and like neurotic and like nervous Cage, he doesn't really curse. And instead he says, "Oh, pygmies." And it's delightful. I thought that was great.
That's your new word now.
Oh, pygmies. And he also gets like some choice line readings in this movie and a lot of freakouts, you know. Perhaps none better than this one, which is a contender for one of my favorite lines in any movie ever, when he's at the pharmacy. And he's in the middle of a freakout. He ran out of his meds. And he's like at the pharmacy trying to get more.
Mrs. Watson, don't forget to drink plenty of water with that.
Hi. Excuse me. Hi.
I'll be right with you, sir.
Hi, I need a refill of this. I don't have a prescription.
Sir, please wait your turn.
I know, but this is an emergency.
Hey, buddy, ever heard of a line?
Hey, have you ever been dragged to the sidewalk and beat until you're pissed blood?
And the guy says, "Hey, buddy, wait in the back of the line." And Cage, like, just shoots back at him and really quickly says, "Hey, have you ever been dragged onto the sidewalk and beaten until you pissed blood?"
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta hit that blood. It's really weird.
God, it is a beautiful line reading from Nicolas Cage. I was really happy with that.
Yeah, I think that this Matchstick Men marks the proto Cage freakout of the modern era of Cage. Right after this, like we've seen the freakouts from Face Off and Vampire's Kiss and
Deadfall.
Yeah, all these crazy things. Where it's just Cage trying to make a name for himself in some weird way, right? I think those are genuine performances for him, but the early in his career, I mean. Then we get to action movie star, just full-blown Nicolas Cage, and he's doing it still, the same thing. He's doing the same thing, but I feel like they're on a different plane than the early ones.
You're saying the later freakouts are, they have a hollowness to them? Like they're not genuine anymore? Mm-hmm.
No, I feel like they are just a different caliber of some sort. And I don't know what it is yet. I haven't put my finger on it. But when I think of a modern day direct to DVD Nicolas Cage freak out in some fashion. It feels much more like this freak out in the pharmacy in Matchstick Men than it does Vampire's Kiss.
Okay.
I mean, so we'll see how that theory evolves as we go on.
Okay. Well, what's the definitive Cage freakout for you? Let's say that. Like, if you had to point to one, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people would point to the bees and the Wicker Man.
I think that might be the one.
The ABCs and Vampire's Kiss would be a huge one.
Yeah.
But if you're saying the bees and the Wicker Man, that would be kind of the era of freakout that you're talking about, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the type of just ridiculous Cage in like. I mean, he's always screamed random words, so like that can't be the definitive faction factor,
right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just something that I had a, you know. Then later in the same scene when in the pharmacy when the doctor tells him that it's just like estrogen pills or something,
right, menopause.
He's
pills.
Like, menopause pills. He's like, bullshit, man. Like he develops a random accent.
These are supplements.
What?
This packet contains supplements, sir.
No, no, no. My doctor gave those to me. They're Prefect.
They're supplements, sir.
Bullshit, man! Prefects!
Supplefem.
Prefects!
Aisle 4,
Prefects.
Sir.
Prefects!
That was great.
Which is hilarious, and it, like, doesn't make any sense. and I think a lot of it stems from the character in Matchstick Men is having a neurotic breakdown, right? When he's having these outbursts.
Right.
And that kind of feeling is the feeling I get when I see later era Cage freakouts.
Okay.
that there's just this total unhinged going on.
Fair enough. I think that's we just spent like 10 minutes talking about the nuances of the Cage freakout.
But that's what this podcast is all for.
What else would this podcast be for, you know? Yeah. Now, Mike, how do you think this role fits into the roles that we've seen Nicolas Cage play so far?
I feel like it's kind of another natural progression for him in some way, right? Like he's done the leading man, heartthrob character. He's done the action star. And I think it's an interesting thing. Like you said, when you think con man, you think Brad Pitt and George Clooney from Ocean's 11, right? The suave, they've got it all collected. They've got the plan together.
Yeah.
But that's the complete opposite of what Roy is in this character is in this movie. And I think it's interesting to see Cage take the flip the archetype basically of the con man to fit his strengths, like you said.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I do think there's a lot of there's not a ton of connection between some of his past movies, but it does seem like a kind of natural progression. You're right about that. I do think Cage brings a lot of similar vocal tics that he used in Adaptation for this one.
Yes.
It kind of feels like a similar kind of neurotic kind of performance. To that end, and I did mention the rock connection before with the character not cursing so much. Also, Nicolas Cage bonding with a non-existent daughter is also the plot of The Family Man.
Wow. Nice.
I was so proud of that realization.
I like it.
So I'm going to ask you, were there any moments or scenes that stood out to you, Mike? But we should talk about the twist first, I think, that final twist.
Yeah.
Because we haven't really gone into what exactly it is. Literally, the entire movie was made up.
Yep.
Sam Rockwell was conning Nicolas Cage, and by extension, the filmmakers were conning the audience the entire time. Cage does not actually have a daughter. The therapist, the cops, and the guy that they were conning, all of them were in on it. Cage ends up losing all of his money, and Rockwell skips town. Apparently, even though that's part of the novel, they left that out of the script at first, thinking audience wouldn't want to see their hero wind up with nothing. And Ridley Scott suggests they put it back in, and that they added the one-year later sequence to offer some closure.
Oh, interesting.
So here's the thing. That final twist is preposterous. Like, like absolutely batshit insane, you know?
Yeah.
It is the kind of thing where if you think about it for even a second, it completely unravels. there is no conceivable way that Sam Rockwell could pull that plan off, right? I mean, I guess.
Like, it sort of leans into the, like, you know, use your expectations against you or against the mark thing. So, like, it's in some weird con man movie kind of way, sure.
There are so many moving parts to that plan.
That's fair. Very fair. Yeah.
You have to orchestrate things exactly perfectly. You have to anticipate every move that Nicolas Cage is going to make. He could have rejected the daughter outright when he first met her, and that would have destroyed the con. Right?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's but I do think the epilogue sequence with special guest Frank Kranz does
show stopping.
It does make that twist work. And I will say, while the twist was happening, I was like, oh, shit. Like, it was working on me in the moment. But as the movie was ending, I was like, that made no sense. Like, that's
like, wait a second. Yeah.
But I think the epilogue sequence really cements it and makes it work because it does complete Nicolas Cage's arc. You know,
right.
After being left with nothing, forced out of the con man game for good, Nicolas Cage has finally rebuilt a life, reconnected with his daughter and his fake daughter, Angela, leaving their conversation with mutual respect for each other. Without that final scene, I think the movie would have really shit the bed in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah. If he stumbles out of the fake hospital room, goes to his safety deposit box and finds he has $100 left or whatever they left him.
Yeah.
That would be the most downer ending of a movie ever. Like, that'd be terrible.
Yeah. I mean, and we were talking about this before the podcast started, and I think we talked about it a little bit at the beginning. This is the second time you've seen the movie, or at least possibly the third time or fourth time, maybe even the 10th time. Who knows? But you don't remember it.
Who knows?
But you kind of had like a vague memory of what the movie was like, and then you kind of remembered what the twist was early on in the movie. And that kind of deflated some of the movie for you. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. There was the scene when Roy meets, his daughter in the park for the first time, and like they actually hang out, and I was like, is this all a con? Like, I randomly had that thought, and I was like, I swear to God. And that's when I wrote my note down. I was like, the daughter's a con, maybe, question mark. And then they pull off the laundromat con with the fake lotto ticket, and like, wow, look at what a natural con artist she is. I was like, this is so obvious, come on. And then I was like, wait, am I just remembering what the movie is? Like,
yeah, fair. I will say, I did not see the twist coming. Like, as somebody who's watching the movie for the first time, had no knowledge about what was going on in the movie. I didn't research the movie or watch a trailer or anything like that. I just went in completely blind, and I did not see it coming. I was genuinely surprised and shocked and confused as to the probability that could possibly happen, but still, I did not see it coming. And actually, you mentioned that the sequence where Cage is teaching Angela how to do that laundromat con. That is my favorite sequence in the movie. I think it's the most fun. Their dynamic is terrific, and I love watching people tricking other people into giving them money. I just think it's a really entertaining thing to see in movies. It's also a key part of why I love Better Call Saul. That's a pretty big part of that show in the first two seasons. And, it's just really engaging, especially when you have somebody like Nicolas Cage, like Bob Odenkirk, like participating in it and like giving a really interesting and like, you know, just playing it very smooth and like pretending to be like bumbling and like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. Or like, you know, just giving that person enough to go on. I feel like there's a really cool artistry to that whole con man procedures. I feel like
The con artist,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah, the con artist. That was also a great line in the movie where she was like, so you're a con man, and he's like, no, con artist. I feel like people are listening to me talk about this and being like, wow, he really appreciates the art of being a con man. What if Mike is a con man?
Is this podcast fake all along, Mike?
There is... You haven't actually listened to 40 episodes of this. That's
have you just been recording and then deleting these and never posting them? not telling me.
Honestly, no one would ever know. Colin's been in on it since the beginning.
Mother of God. I applaud your efforts.
But we should talk about Alison Lohman in this movie, because I think she is phenomenal.
Yeah, she does a really great job. Yeah. I think but you pointed out at the beginning that her portrayal as a 14 or 15-year-old or however old she's supposed to be is crazy.
Yeah.
She does a really good job.
It's insane. And she's a really fun kid to watch. And the twist kind of does recontextualize some stuff that we see her do throughout the movie. And specifically, you don't really see her alone that often. But you do see her alone when Cage leaves her alone at the house. Like, it cuts back to her exploring his house. And you see what she's doing when she's on her own. So, for example, she's smoking a cigarette, which is an odd thing for a 14-year-old kid to do. But it's not outside the realm of possibility.
Right. She skateboards. She might smoke.
Exactly. She's like, at first it kind of makes her seem like she's a rebellious, like, latchkey kid. Like, that's all that kind of the smoking thing indicates. And then later, of course, we find out that she's an adult woman, a very adult woman, based on the dress that she was wearing. It recontextualizes that entire scene. And I think that's a pretty cool thing. Allison Lohman is really great in this movie. It's a shame she hasn't really been in much since Drag Me to Hell came out in 2009. Apparently, she took some time off from acting because she had kids. And it was like a 6-year break. So I think she started appearing in things recently, but it hasn't like been anything big. So it'd be cool if she like made some kind of big comeback. I really enjoy her stuff in this movie and Drag Me to Hell. Are there any other scenes in the movie that stood out to you, Mike? Anything that you wanted to discuss?
Not particularly. I mean, I think that just the cons when they're happening, the scene in the airport, like when they make the suitcase swap with the fake Mark, apparently. just those kind of things, because those are tense, and it's Cage and Rockwell doing their suaviest suave.
Right, yeah.
Nothing in particular other than those are standout. Those are cool scenes.
Yes, those cons were a lot of... Like, the cons are easily the highlight of the movie, and also Cage and Angela together, just like them bonding was a lot of fun, like going to bowling. The healing power of Domino's Pizza was always entertaining. But yeah, I do worry if I saw the movie again, like if I saw it a second time, this is the sort of twist that would deflate pretty much everything, like right from the get-go. Like it would deflate tension. It would deflate a lot of tension from certain scenes. Like, would the scene where Chuck shows up at Cage's house and Angela shoots him have the same impact if we know that none of that happened, that that's all part of the con, you know? That's,
yeah.
So there's stuff like that. But, the movie does have a lot of snappy dialogue, some very funny editing choices. There was one really funny editing bit when he's first meeting Angela, I think they're in the diner, and she's talking about how he was a con man, and she's like, oh, is that how you ended up a criminal? And, like, as soon as she says that, it cuts to these two cops who just, like, get up from their table.
Yeah.
So that was like a very funny choice, and like nothing happens from that. They just like walk out the restaurant, but it's like a very funny like quick bit where you see Cage get nervous for a second, and it's good stuff. But yeah. Otherwise, is there anything else you wanted to mention about Magic Pim before we move on to Netflix reviews, Mike?
No, I think I want to hear what the people have to say.
Let's do that. Let's move on to Netflix reviews for Matchstick Men starting right now. Here's a 3-star review of Matchstick Men. Not a Nicolas Cage fan, Ridley Scott does some entertaining turns at presenting the story, but this one's not even on my top 100 list.
Okay.
I love that review because he's saying...
That's the whole review.
That's the whole review. He's saying this movie is so bad that it's not even in the top 100 movies he's ever seen.
Wow.
So, I got to imagine what made that 100 list. I have no idea.
I don't know, yeah.
Here's a 4-star review of Matchstick Men. Don't you just love the reviewers who claim they have better things to do with their lives and that this was a waste of their precious time? I would love to know who tied them to the chair and made them do it. After all, it is the kind of crime I would love to happen to me.
What the f-
And you need to appreciate their time, because after all, they even took more of it for you, just to tell you that their time has been wasted. This is not a Dumb and Dumber movie.
What?
This is a classic that has been remade according to modern philosophy and the conveniences of today. It was funny, sad, scary, and had excellent acting. I need my time wasted like this more often.
I mean, sure. That person's very passionate about their time.
Very much. Here's a 5-star review of Matchstick Men. It's really the only review you need. It goes like this. Have you ever been dragged to the sidewalk and beaten until you pissed blood? Nicolas Cage for the win.
That'll track.
That's all you need. But I do have a couple more. Here's 5 stars. A 5-star review. I should have placed that one last. Dumb me. Here's a 5-star review of Matchstick Men. I love all of Cage's movies, from Raising Arizona to Red Rock, etc., etc. But this was a great performance by Cage on a more softer side. I think it may be my favorite now. The chemistry between him and Lohman was awesome. Cage has that ability to play just about anything you give him. The story is sweet, nasty, sad, happy, and some OCD to boot. All the emotions required to make this movie special.
And OCD is an emotion?
Apparently. And this one hit it perfectly. Imagine Cage playing in Con Air, then this one. Totally amazing contrast. Great movie. And I'm an action guy. 6 stars for performance.
Wow.
Yeah.
Went out of their way to give us an extra star.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Here's a 1-star review of Match Stick Men. Nick Cage is a shell of what he used to be when he dazzled in Valley Girl and mesmerized in Red Rock West. Heck, I even liked him in Leaving Las Vegas. Please, Nick, please end your career now. I'm begging you.
Wow. Harsh words.
Harsh words. I got another 1-star review of Matchstick Men. This movie would have been okay if not for Nicolas Cage's forced acting, which falls short. He should have called it quits after Valley Girl.
That's the same person.
Done us all a favor. I don't know, man. There were 2 different reviews. Had to be 2 different people. Who would review the same movie twice, Mike? It's like the tag, it's like the line in Die Hard 2. How could the same shit happen to the same guy twice? How could the same guy review the same movie twice? That's insane.
It's unheard of.
Finally, here's a 4-star review of Matchstick Men. Matchstick Men is a comedy starring Nicolas Cage as a con man who suffers from obsessive-compulsive disorder. I have a hatred for Nicolas Cage because he tends to get macho roles when I personally think he is the antithesis of macho. I could kick his ass.
Wow.
However, the preview for this looked promising enough that I was willing to put up with him, and it was worth it. The OCD con man finds out he has a daughter and bonds with her while teaching her the trade. The movie is really quite funny, and since I think you should see this one, I'm not going to say anything more about it.
I love how it starts out on such an attack and then turns into a really pleasant review.
It's so aggressive. Yeah. I could kick Nicolas Cage's ass, but you know what? This is a really pleasant movie. I think you should watch it. All right. So I think that wraps up our discussion on Matchstick Men, Mike. I really enjoyed it. I don't know how much I would enjoy it a second time, but for what it is, I think it's a really engaging, really fun, very slick kind of con man movie. And that's the kind of I really enjoy that kind of subgenre of movie. What did you do you have any final thoughts on the movie?
I did have fun with it. I thought it's pretty cool. It's thankfully not a very long movie. So even though I remembered / called the plot, I guess I just remembered it, really. it kind of robbed it of some of its punch, but it's still fun to see Rockwell and Cage do their comment thing.
Absolutely. So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com and plus my work at crookedscoreboard.com. That's up there, too. Thank you so much for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCriccio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, you can subscribe to our podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Help support this podcast and Film Book by taking part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us in 2 weeks for another episode of The Complete Works, in which we will be talking about a film that'll probably be pretty an interesting review. I'll say it's really going to be an interesting review, say at least. 2004's National Treasure. This is like a generational touchstone.
Oh yeah,
for us, it's kind of weird because the movie didn't get like great reviews when it came out. I haven't seen it in like 10 years,
at least. Yeah,
but like everybody I know has fond memories of National Treasure. I can't explain it, but it was just a movie that like everybody saw.
Yeah, I think it was our generation's like Indiana Jones in some way.
Kind of, our low rent Indiana Jones. I mean, The Mummy was also kind of our Indiana Jones.
That's true.
So the point is we were blessed with a plethora of Indiana Joneses.
Yeah, exactly.
And the next one is National Treasure. So we're pretty stoked to dig back into that one. I'm very excited to revisit that one. Plus, you can keep an eye out for Film Bookcast, where we're probably going to be talking Baby Driver on the next episode. And Mike, I'm fucking excited to talk about that with you. I saw it last night. I'm so jealous. It's so damn good. You got to see it as soon as you can. It made me want to download the soundtrack and do donuts in the parking lot like immediately after leaving that theater.
Yes, perfect.
So that's what we'll be talking about next. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thanks for getting in the cage.
Boom, Nick Cage, motherfucker! Boom, Nick Cage, motherfucker!